This is tape two, side one, Crawford Thompson interview, 7/29/87. Okay, continuing our discussion. Why don't you lead into that, Joe?
Yeah, just before the break, during the break, you were talking about tooling in two plants for identical aircraft, gradually diverging in its specifications and the problem of spares.
Yes, we were building C-54s, which was the military version of the DC-4, both in the Chicago plant and in one of the Los Angeles plants. And as you know, government contracts for manufactured goods that require spare parts have a provision that states that spare parts will be interchangeable for all of the items manufactured. But as time went on in Chicago and in Santa Monica, the tooling kept getting out of alignment through use that was excessive to what you would normally expect to be the life cycle of a piece of tooling. And toward the end of World War II, the parts from one of those plants simply wouldn't fit an airplane that was manufactured at the other plant, which created two problems. One, that violated the specifications of the contracts, and secondly, the shipment of spare parts to the commands in the war theaters had to be monitored closely to be sure that the set from Chicago, for example, didn't go to a squadron that had airplanes made in California. This obviously created a logistics problem for the Army Air Corps, and it created a contractual problem for Douglas in the sense that it was in violation of some of the terms of the contract. There was no real solution to the former problem because until the war ended, it wasn't feasible to stop production of airplanes at either plant. And with respect to the contractual problem, the government recognized that it was also a party to not permitting stoppage of work to correct the alignment of tooling. So the requirement was forgiven with respect to the contracts covering the buildings of the C-54s.
Just before our brief break, we were discussing the post-war situation, and you were starting to talk about Douglas's development of new business ideas. They were trying some unusual things in terms of metal skating rinks and boats, and they were directing their energies towards the commercial market. Were there any other areas of new development that you were aware of, for example, in the guided missile area or that sort of thing?
I would say nothing terribly significant. I recall Douglas received a contract to review some captured drawings of the German V, whatever it was, missiles.
V2, probably.
I've forgotten which one it was, but let's say V2. And the purpose of the contract was for the Douglas Engineering Department to make production drawings from whatever it was they had captured. And in the event that, I assume, in the event that for some reason the Air Force wanted to build a few and test them or whatever the ultimate use was, Douglas's only function was to make production drawings, which it did. Then Douglas had a contract with the Aerojet Corporation to assist them. Well, that's not right. For Aerojet to assist Douglas in some design work on future I'm not sure whether rocketry is the right name or not, but the propulsion of some sort. And Aerojet did do both some engineering work and they, I believe, tested the propulsion. I'm a little lost here since I'm not an engineer, but we did have a contract, which I negotiated, and we did have them help us on a, I've forgotten who Douglas's contract was with now in the government. Anyway, the general subject was propulsion, and we did have them working for us for roughly 2 years, as I remember.
So as, I'm just trying to paint the picture here, at the end of the war you have this significant activity related to the termination of many contracts, and then the possibility of the RAND contract comes forward. And one of my thoughts was, and you characterized this during our break, was, you know, how important for was this $10 million contract that was in likelihood coming to Douglas at that time?
Well, I'd say the contract was unimportant to Douglas. First of all, Mr. Douglas didn't want it. He didn't like the idea, and he, I think, from the beginning foresaw the obvious conflict of interest problem of Douglas working on long-range planning, if that's the right word, for the Air Force, when Douglas clearly might be bidding to be the manufacturer of the results of some of this research. So the only way he ultimately agreed to accept the contract was with the understanding that as soon as it was feasible, it would be spun off and divorced from Douglas Aircraft. And that was the basis on which he said he would agree to entering into a contract. Now, as far as the $10 million was concerned, the reason I say it was unimportant to Douglas, we started literally the first day of charging was in December of 1945, and it was Frank Kolbaum and his secretary, which was hardly the major part of the employees of Douglas Aircraft. And the group grew slowly, simply because most of the technical people were going to come from outside Douglas Aircraft, dictated mainly by the nature of the skills required over a very broad spectrum. And it was the problem of getting the first olive out of the bottle, in the sense of to attract top flight people in a wide variety of fields, the biggest attraction is if they are going to be able to come and work with colleagues of equal stature. Now, if you can achieve that, I'm not saying salary isn't important, but it's not as important to most of these people because they're fairly high up in their fields to begin with, as working on interesting projects with the top people in their field. That's the attraction. But somebody's got to be first, and that's why it was slow going for a while. In fact, when they first started Project RAND in the end of 1945, there was Arthur Raymond made space in the general offices of Douglas Aircraft for the small group that they were attracting, a few from the outside and mainly from within Douglas, and it was within the engineering department of the general offices. However, in I believe it was May of 1946, we leased the first piece of space at 4th and Broadway in downtown Santa Monica, partly because we needed more space for these people, but also to give an appearance of detachment from Douglas proper, we used to refer to it as. Even though we all had Douglas badges, just simply getting it out of the building was at least some semblance of disassociation. Let me go back for a minute, if I may, on my involvement.
Certainly.
As I said, I was involved with Larry Tollefson in the negotiation of the original contract, which started out as a letter of intent, which is normal, superseded by a contract as soon as they can get it written. And because it was going to be slow going to build up a technical staff, We did a lot of subcontracting at the beginning. We had projects that were starting and we needed help to work on them, and if we weren't able to get them on the payroll in Santa Monica, why, we would have to go to other sources. I was involved in writing like the first half a dozen or so subcontracts. And these were with fairly large companies. I'm thinking of Westinghouse, Collins Radio Company, who else was there?
I believe there was one with the Battelle Institute.
Battelle, Varian Associates was a little later. Boeing, North American, quite a few. And these were usually they were studies of one sort or another. I'm probably the wrong person to describe the work, but Collins Radio developed the plans for a huge energy source, much larger than one that had ever been built. I'm not sure anything ultimately came of it, but I assume the point of the study was whether it could be done or not. And I think they proved that it could be done. I've forgotten, frankly, what the other companies were doing. But the point of this is that that's where we got the manpower to work on the research projects from the very beginning, because we simply didn't have them here. Now, there were some people from Douglas, technical people. Dick Goldstein is probably the outstanding example. Ultimately, became senior vice president. He had been in charge of the engineering laboratories at Douglas Aircraft. And he came and he brought several people from the laboratories with him. One man named Jim Lipp, LIPP, became one of our department heads. A fellow by the name of Glad Putt, P-U-T-T. Became an assistant to the president. And a number of others, but there weren't all that many from Douglas's technical staff. Who
would they have been transferred, say, in early 1946?
Probably middle 1946. The ones I referred to would be somewhere in mid 1946. And then, of course, the clerical people, et cetera. Now, Scott King came back out of the Navy, I've forgotten the exact month, but it was roughly, as I remember, March of 46. And he did a couple of things. Well, he was working for Larry Tollefson, that he had before, and he was the senior of the three of us. The first thing he did, we were in the process then of starting to deliver a lot of DC-4s, and he took over the contractual aspect of delivery and completion. In those days, we had to fly them to Nevada for tax reasons and deliver them there rather than in California. And he did that, first of all, and got that going and under control. And it seems to me he was on loan to the director of public relations, because one of his people was ill, and he worked with that for a while. But then in it had to be by May of 46, I think, when we moved outside, although he briefly was up in that engineering office. It was after Dick Goldstein went to work for Frank that they needed an administrative person to do everything that needed to be done. So anyway, Scott took over at that point. So I stopped writing incidentally, the Douglas was still organized functionally. So Scott and I were in a different department from everyone in Project RAN. We were in the contract administration department. They were in some department of engineering and had a number, and I've forgotten what it was. And in fact, Scott and I stayed in the contract administration department until we broke off as the RAND Corporation. We were not in the department. I mean, this is just the way the Douglas organization worked.
So RAND was dispersed administratively,
yeah,
in Douglas, and it was, yeah, just another contract number in a certain sense.
Well, yeah, they had their own department number. And Scott and I were the only two who weren't in that department. Frank was in it, everyone else was in it, but we weren't, because under their functional organization, we fell in the contract administration department. Now, he was assigned son, when I stopped writing the subcontract, he was assigned, put it the other way around, he was assigned because the administrative load was growing within Project RAND, and Frank and Goldie needed help. So they went to Larry Tollefson, and Scott was deemed to be the logical person, so he stopped delivering airplanes and the other things he was doing and became the administrator for Project RAND. At that point, I reverted to full-time on the Navy work. And then I had no association for just about a year. I say no association, I was obviously aware of what was going on, not on a day-to-day basis, but as far as the contract was concerned. But there wasn't too much to do with the contract, since it had been written for a 3-year period with $10 million, which was more than we could possibly spend in that period of time, or at least it appeared so in 1946. So I did nothing really with Project RAND until, I believe it was May, that's within a month anyway, of 1947, when RAND was trying to start a social science department, which we had not had before, and we had the head of our mathematics department, John Williams, had been like one of the first few people hired on the research staff other than from Douglas. And he was the head of the mathematics department, but he also was a social scientist. So he agreed to at least temporarily be the head of the social science department when we could find one. Anyway, they decided to have a big social science conference in New York City, inviting social scientists from all over the country, I guess. And behind this was, I'm sure, recruiting some good people for the nucleus of a social science department. Anyway, they needed someone to run this. It was like a 3-week conference they put on, in 2 or 3 weeks. So anyway, Scott was asked to go back and be on the spot and handle all the details of getting that accomplished. At which point, Goldie called Larry Tollefson and asked if he could borrow me to move down during this period of 3 weeks or so, which I did. And make a long story short, by the time Scott got back, it was a two-person job, and I never got back to my office in the main plant. So from May on, I was back with Project RAND, and just simply never, well, in fact, I didn't, the work grew so fast that I didn't have time to go back and do any Navy work or anything else, so I simply spent full time on Project RAND beginning then. So other than that 1-year hiatus, I had been with it constantly from the fall of 45 on.
When you were doing your work at Douglas during the war, did you have a clearance? Was that a necessary part of contract administration?
No, I don't think we had clearances at Douglas until Project RAND came along. When I say we, I don't mean that no one in Douglas did, but I think it was confined to the engineering department, because there was nothing really classified about the manufacturing processes. The only thing that would have been classified, and I don't think they could have had much of this during the war, would have been engineering plans, except they were too busy working on the production of the aircraft. And you'd have had to clear everyone in the plant because, you know, you can see all the airplanes being built on the assembly line. There's really nothing there. And the sensitive things like a bomb site, which didn't happen to be in El Segundo, but things like that wouldn't go in until after the airplane left Douglas anyway. I don't, some of the people like Frank Kolbaum clearly had to have them because, you know, he was on loan of the Manhattan Project, et cetera, but I don't think any of the rest of us did, to my knowledge.
Okay, well,
there's no need that I can
When did you require one as you came into the Project Rand activity?
Well, I think clearly we had them the day we broke away, I know that. I can't remember within Douglas when I might have had one. I'm sure I had to have one when I moved down there.
Okay, that's fine.
I would guess May of 47 is when I first had a clearance.
Except for, I think the project was had guards and everything. Its location.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So that in
certainly
order to
did.
Get in, if you look
yeah.
at
Well, I'm sure when I moved down there I had one now. I may have gotten it earlier than moving down, but I can't pinpoint that.
Okay.
It didn't get involved with our work particularly in the sense we see the first statement of work of Project Rand was classified, and it was classified for a number of years. Why, no one could really figure out. And then we decided this is kind of ridiculous. So I remember I wrote the letter to the Air Force, to Wright Field, saying, can't we get it declassified? Well, somebody like Frank had paved the way. I mean, it didn't do this out of a blue sky. And because they happened to be writing a supplement at the time, the way they did it, instead of declassifying the statement of work, they sent us a supplement with the same words in it, verbatim, with no classification stamp on it. Well, that's all well and good, except the only way you can get something declassified is by an Air Force officer authorized to do so. So the darn contract stamped classified here, and the supplement and all ongoing contracts with the same statement of work and unclassified. But you can't get the darn stamp off the other one. There was no downgrading system in those days as there is today. So, in fact, just before I left Rand, I retired, I had a bunch of stuff in the basement. I finally went up and made our security officer I had him destroy some of them that I didn't think had historical significance. I must have had like 50 or 60 pieces of paper down there that had a classification on them, but no, because there was no downgrading stamp, and you can't put a downgrading stamp on without somebody authorized to do so going through it. And you know, here they are, and they're clearly not classified in my view, but you can't get the damn stamps off them. So. Well, anyway, it isn't a problem today unless you got something that's 38 or 40 years old that's got it on, and you got to get somebody in the Air Force to declassify it, or your head security officer. The reason the Air Force didn't want to do all those was there was such a volume of them around, they didn't feel it was all that important in the sense. No one was going to do anything with them if they did declassify them, so they didn't have much interest in them.
So they're still in storage, those materials?
No, I got rid of, no, no, well, I had most of them destroyed. A few I had our security officer get declassified by whoever declassified. See, we have Air Force officers stationed here, but mainly they're here to do research in whatever their specialty is. As a sideline, they have to classify current research, that, like somebody writes a paper and it needs to be classified. They have to do that, which is enough of an imposition on their time without running through the files in the basement to see if there's something else they can find and declassify. You know, that just isn't going to happen.
But you have you retained other non-classified materials that you consider historical?
Yeah.
What?
Not in a system. I mean, I'm a saver. I didn't do it for necessarily for historical reasons. But I did it because I don't throw anything away usually. But when I was cleaning up in the sense of reorganizing the files and so on before I retired, I did, well, because I threw some things away, like those early subcontracts. I probably would have saved them, but others felt that no one would ever want to look at them again. And, a few things like that were disposed of, but well, let me put it the other way around. I didn't go through files and say, I'm going to save this and throw this away, other than the things that have been classified. What I did, I said, is there, to myself, is there anything in this file, would it be of any use historically, and is this the only place you could find it? If my answer was yes, I did not throw it away.
Okay, so those files remain here at RAND, or those are things that you have at home?
No, they're at RAND. I didn't take any of them at home.
Well, perhaps we can talk a little bit more about what remains, the character of it, at later on here. At one point, I knew I kind of interrupted your narrative, and it was just at the point where you had talked about the list of items that you wanted to have consider as allowable expenses. Was there in your sequence of recollection that you want to sort of include additional material between that time, the fall of 45 and 46, when we began discussing the contract?
Not really, because as I mentioned, when the lawyer came out here and sat down and collapsed this in with this one catch-all provision, that became the cost section of the contract. So there was no further discussion of it, and that's the way it appeared in the original contract.
So the next step simply was the contract.
Right.
Coming through.
He went back and wrote the contract, and there were discussions of other things like the fixed overhead rate, for example, but not of the cost provisions, because he solved it when he was out here, and he went back and gave the language to the contracting officer and said, put it in the contract. And it came out when the contract was ready for signature, and we signed it.
Were you involved in discussions about the fixed fee amount?
Not the fixed fee. Mr. Douglas said 6% or I won't do it, so that kind of set the fee, and there was really no discussion of that. It was reasonable compared to what other companies were getting, and by any test, he didn't try and hold anyone up on the fee, and he was getting it from the other government agencies, and so there was really no particular discussion. And he said 6%, and that's what it was.
I think we can move on then to the kinds of things you did after you came in May of 47.
Okay.
Now, if you, particularly since there's now two of you administering one simple contract, I'm just kind of curious what kinds of activities filled your days.
One not so simple contract. Well, despite all the words in the contract, and broad as they might be, we still had to deal with both, I'm going to say Air Force from now on. I've forgotten when they became the Air Force. And the first contract was Air Corps, but they made two shifts in names in the next years. We had an Air Force auditor and an Air Force administrative contracting officer. In fact, we had two contracting officers at Douglas. And since the contract had been written with Douglas, why they were the people we dealt with, we knew them, or I did anyway, in the sense I dealt with them on Douglas' other contracts. We were fortunate to have some very good contracting officers. The auditors turned over a little too much of that, not too much, but they did turn over, and I didn't know them as well. However, they had a hard time adjusting to approving costs for anything but a hardware-type contract. But however, they were reasonable people. But for example, on books, since we were charging directly the contract, and one of the reasons was we were buying a lot, because some of these were like background reference books, et cetera, that like a physicist wanted in his office, et cetera. So we were buying more than we would be on an ongoing basis. We knew that, and we felt but it was proper to charge them. And now I'm purposely distinguishing overhead now, even though we charge overhead directly also, and would have if the books had been up there, but we'd have had the same problem. Namely, they felt they wanted to approve what we were buying, especially if it was something that looked to them like it was more personal in nature for the individual and needed to perform the contract. That was their concern. So we ended up writing an awful lot of letters for approval, just in the book and periodical area. And, you know, they wanted some justification as to what's the person going to use it for. So we generated an awful lot of correspondence, just getting costs a lot. Travel was another, because some of these trips had costs associated with them, that social science conference, it had a lot of costs connected with it. The purpose of it was to attract people and establish a social science department, as well as have an interchange of whatever social scientists interchange about when they get together. So we felt that was a reasonable charge, the contract. But again, the Air Force was nervous because Douglas certainly didn't hold three-week conferences in New York City at a hotel of social scientists. And so we simply had to conform, and we were willing to do so as long as they didn't disallow costs. So you get into this. Now again, you see, we have no procurement regulations available at this point in time. This old TD 5000 from the Treasury Department, which says not an awful lot, really isn't useful to anyone for this sort of thing.
The list had been collapsed to a general form. Mm-hmm.
Plus,
I presume one of the ideas about the list was you wouldn't have to put a special justification.
That's right. Well, it was collapsed. You remember when I talked about the similar and dissimilar services. the intent of that, of course, was to approve all other types, but the local Air Force people, with some justification, didn't want to lean on that all the time. They weren't sure what it meant either. I'm not sure the lawyer was sure what he meant, but he just wanted fewer items in the contract. And our informal understanding with the contracting officer was that as long as we wrote on the ones that, in his view, needed some approving, in addition to the catch-all item in the contract, why we did it. And then we had, let me inject one other thing here. Since it was always understood that we were going to split off into a separate corporation, our original target date was July 1st of 1948. As you notice, we didn't make it. It was November 1st, ultimately. But we had two administrative problems to wrestle with. The first one was first of all, at some point, we're going to have to train an accounting group, et cetera, because we decided early on that we didn't like any of Douglas's policies. That's an overstatement, but we wanted to formulate our own policies in really all areas, personnel, travel, fringe benefits, and so on. So we also realized we weren't going to get any financial help from Douglas. Their board felt strongly that they should not give away any of the stockholders' equity, which got carried to the extreme of, we had these beaten up desks that they gave us when we became Project Rand within Douglas, which had been built by the Defense Planning Corporation in World War II. I don't know if you ever saw one of those or not. They were the flimsiest creations you've ever seen. You could barely get the drawers in and out. And they were as cheap as you could make a desk and chair. Well, that's all we had in these leased quarters. So when we became Rand, we thought Douglas would say, keep that stuff. But no, they charged us for them. So anyway, we got no financial help from Douglas. We didn't really expect anything major, but we thought they might have made a few minor gestures. So that meant for us to receive reimbursement from day one when we became a separate corporation, we had to have all of our policies approved by the government. Now, this meant all fringe benefit policies, and in those days, the insurance contracting officer was at Wright Field. Your pension plan had to be approved, your group life plan, your group medical plan, or you weren't going to get reimbursed until it was approved. And if you have no money to start with, you got a problem. Also, we had to have a travel policy approved, we had to have an accounting policy approved, property accountability policy, shipping and receiving, and I'm sure there are a few more. But anyway, all your policies under which you're going to incur costs and expect reimbursement from the government have to be approved as policies, or you're not going to get any reimbursement until they are. So that had to be done. And Scott and I, what we did was simply, divide them all up and start writing them. But all this we had to do really outside normal working hours, in the sense, I don't mean that you'd never do it on the job, but it was over and above our normal day's work, because we had to adhere to Douglas's policies, accounting and otherwise, while we were still part of Douglas. But somehow we had to get all these others written, sent to the appropriate government people, and I say all the insurance ones were in Wright Field, then sit down and negotiate with them. They thought our retirement policy was too liberal to begin with. Our argument was, here we are asking these top-flight scientific people to leave their good-paying jobs, come to a company that has that's going to be living on a one-contract, year-to-year basis. We can't offer them job security, so we got to have a decent pension plan.
Can we just pause here while I turn the